And we are live. Hello, everyone. My name is Joshua Gilliland, one of the founding attorneys of the Legal Geeks. With me is Nari Ely, as we once again journey decks of multiple starships from different fleets. And we're going to have a rip-roaring good time with a whole bunch of legal issues, thanks largely to the Klingons being Klingons. Yes. Nari, how you doing tonight?
Doing really good. Had a fun weekend visiting some nearby family, some nieces. How about yourself, Josh?
I am well. I'm grateful to have Star Trek on a weekly basis. This is the penultimate episode, and they seem to be swinging for the fences. And it's, you know, every episode should be a base hit. It doesn't have to be a home run, but it's got to be good. If you get a double, that's fantastic. They've been doing triples the last two episodes, and God bless them for delivering such an amazing showcase of true love of Star Trek. What have you thought of this episode?
So you thought it was a triple hitter? I honestly thought this one was a home run. the sheer density of references, first of all, means that I need to rewatch it again just to, or finish doing this podcast with you, because I'm sure you noticed more of them, but to go back and try to spot more of them, because it was incredibly reference dense in a really good way. I love just the entire concept of the episode was really creative and it was extremely well executed. I really enjoyed going onto the lower decks of all of the different ships. The one at the end was particularly hilarious. it was all handled extremely well. I am hopeful that this is also hinting that they're going to be an additional Vulcan member of the crew at some point that will join them on lower decks. I'm getting ahead of myself. Point being, I was absolutely head over heels with this episode. I mean, it's all been great, but this one might be the highest note so far in the season for me.
I've watched this episode three times so far, and it is just chock full of references. It's very reverential to Trek. And the way that they do great justice to the Klingons and the Vulcans is a ton of fun. Mm-hmm. It's like, for example, in the captain, the Vulcan captain's quarters, I'm pretty sure that's a Kishara that's in the background, which contained the teachings of Surak and was seen in the Enterprise season four episodes that dealt with the Forge, the Awakening, and the Kishara. And it's like, wow, nice, deep, subtle cuts for lots of Trek love. In addition to lots of great stuff with the Klingons. Now, with my first draft of the outline, I hit the Klingons first since there's a lot connected to them. But there's a lot also with the Cerritos and the Vulcan ship. Mm-hmm. Let's proceed. And we'll give you the dealer's choice of which ship to hit first, since there are little issues in so many of them.
I do want to start with the Klingons. I think that's got to be the meatiest topic here from at least a legal geek's perspective. First of all, it actually, like, that perspective on the lower decks was. So setting aside legal issues, Josh, that perspective on the lower decks was great. it was simultaneously perhaps a more interesting and fun place to be on lower decks, and obviously more hazardous. So I think the first issue that we can talk about as legal geeks, though, is one that we've talked about a fair amount on other legal geeks podcasts and panel talks and things like that, which is how the law, at least, handles insubordination. So we talked about this a lot, Josh, if you remember, in the second season of The Mandalorian. There was a fair amount of, and this happens actually a lot in Star Wars, a fair amount of shooting of insubordinates. It is not something that happens as often in Trek, except, of course, when we have Klingons. And in particular, a Klingon that turns out to not be such a great captain at the end of it. But so the long story short is that the military, at least in how we handle it, and this is obviously how Starfleet handles it, and it's, you know, we actually get to see a number of court martials throughout the show and things like that. There is a lot of process in the military. The UCMJ is not just, you know, something written on a napkin. It's not just a drumhead trial to go ahead and reference another episode. There's a lot of guarantees of process. First of all, there's very few things that you could actually be shot for or executed for in the military, period. And I believe the last time that the US military actually executed someone was, I think it was in the 60s. It's been decades since the military actually executed somebody. And that one was for a very good reason. You can look up the history of it. It was not for desertion, for failing to follow an order. It was for actual, what we would consider civilian crimes. It was for murder, rape, all that good stuff. So that is how the UCMJ handles it. If you are going to be up for something in which the death penalty is at issue, you get a huge amount of process. You cannot, you know, one of the things that you can get executed for is not insubordination, coincidentally. It is also not desertion, so this didn't necessarily come up in this episode, but it does in a lot of other sci-fi franchises where a person, you know, as part of maybe refusing to follow an order, flees the battle or just attempts to flee the battle or something like that. Also not on the list. In any event, in this case, of course, we are not dealing with Starfleet, which usually pretty, you know, reasonably mirrors what we expect from the United States Uniform Code of Military Justice. Instead, we are dealing with Klingons, where the general mode of promotion is in fact killing your superior, it seems. So it's a whole other can of worms. I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that a captain can in fact summarily execute their subordinates on a Klingon vessel. What do you think, Josh?
Oh, but we've seen it before. So this episode, a lot of homages to Commander Krug from Star Trek III and General Chang from Star Trek VI. And it down to quoting Shakespeare.
And yes. Oh, yes. That was like one of the, yeah, definitely pick that one up.
If you're going to have Christopher Plummer, he's going to quote Shakespeare. Like, it's, that's just the way it's going to roll. And Krug executed on the spot his gunner for inadvertently destroying the USS Grissom. And then with the gunner saying, like, it was a lucky shot, and Krug saying, actually just shooting him. And then afterwards spitting at the disruptor area and saying animal. So we've seen the Klingons who are opposed to peace, and Krug and Chang both fall into that with wanting to subvert peace. And so there's, it's a tradition. It's a theme that we've seen before. That said, again, like down to the Targ, again, we've seen that before in Star Trek III, and he was a very good boy. So, like, we just...
Also, the pinkish purple blood?
Yep, from Six as well. So, again, all good stuff.
I had a quick question about that, Josh. Yeah. In other media, the blood has not been pinkish purple, right?
Yeah.
So, like, I'm trying to remember... I don't remember Worf ever having pinkish purple blood. Is that correct?
Yeah, they correct. Like when they've to DS9 episodes, like where they're doing blood screenings for the Dominion, you know, they're not, you know, like somebody will cut their hand. They don't.
I remember it being regular looking blood.
Yeah, it's very human looking blood, probably because they don't have a 55 gallon drum of that on tap for.
Also, it looks silly, Josh. It just looks a little, it's just a silly color.
For a really aggressive species.
Yes.
So yeah, something we've seen before. So the Klingon side of this was just perfect. Now down the ship being named Cheetah. Nice, well done. So Captain Dorg killed his first officer for insubordination. And insubordination is not something that gets a summary execution. Now, if the first officer had attacked him physically, then it turns into an issue of self-defense. But this was just straight up murder the first officer. And that's just not good. So there's no legal right of that.
I can tell you within the UCMJ, no. My only question mark is I don't have a manual for the Code of Military Justice of the Klingons, but at least as far as we're concerned, that's obviously no go. I also wanted to correct myself briefly. I said that desertion is not one of the crimes in the UCMJ that can be punished by death. It can. It just has to be in the face of the enemy as opposed to just anywhere. And it also has not been punished by death in decades. So you are, it is just one of those things that is no longer generally punished by death.
Yeah. I mean, even dating back to the Civil War, Lincoln was pardoning guys left and right who dropped their rifles and ran when the shooting started. I mean, like, and that's why in old Civil War movies, you might see somebody, the officer in the back with the sword, trying to rally the guys from running away. And Lincoln's response was like, well, it's perfectly natural to run for your life if you're getting shot at. So he was not inclined to have guys hung for basically not wanting to die.
So it's, I just wanted to, in case anyone was, you know, Googling to see if that was correct, it is technically punishable by death if it's in the face, if it's in the presence of the enemy. We just don't do that anymore. And I would be shocked if such a thing happened. I believe it's also, it has to be, if you're in the presence of the enemy, you're generally in a battle or a state of war. But anyway, continue.
Yeah. So again, just very, very rare. It hasn't happened in a long time. So let's get into what the Klingon captain does. He's supplying WMDs to the Paklids with the goal of, I will destabilize the Federation by getting them into a war, and thus the Empire will then move in to sweep and clean up the pieces. So with doing that, you get the arms trafficking side of it, and that's one very big crime. The other part of this is the captain's developing his own foreign policy that's inconsistent with the Klingon Empire. On Earth, in the United States, we have the Logan Act, and that prohibits US citizens from directly or indirectly commencing correspondence with a foreign government with the intent to influence the measures or conduct of any foreign government or of any officer or agent thereof in relation to any disputes or controversies with the United States. If the Klingons have a version of that, he's definitely doing that, because he's engaging with the Paklids, inconsistent with the Empire, to destabilize the Federation, of which the Klingon Empire is a member of. So you have the foreign policy side of it, you have an insubordination side of it for what he's doing, because he's in the military. It's not a Klingon who's out of the service. This is someone carrying the battle flag on a ship. So all of that's bad. I mean, it's mutinous behavior. It's treasonous type behavior.
Oh, for sure.
And like, there's no good about it.
I just wanted to add a tiny bit on the subject of the Logan Act, which is just that, you know, the spirit of the Logan Act is historically, well, first of all, it's I don't know that we've prosecuted people under it substantially in the past. The spirit of it was generally, I believe, that if someone is holding themselves out as essentially a representative or trying to conduct diplomacy. So, you know, there's interesting historical questions, right? About, for example, I believe it was Nixon before he actually took office, conducting some backdoor diplomacy with the Vietnamese, South Vietnamese government, as just as an example. Even though it technically applies to everybody, the thing that would be most sort of red flaggish, most likely to cause this to be wielded by a prosecutor would be when someone is holding themselves out to be a representative of the government, or I would argue in this circumstance, under the color of law, to apply a slightly related but different legal concept. So kind of like you were saying, Josh, he is in a Klingon bird of prey. He is wearing all the Klingon insignia. He is not, you know, meeting informally with the Paklid to the extent they could even understand that and say, hey, you know, this is off the clock for me, but I have these weapons that I would like to sell you. he's, you know, doing this in a way that even if he does not openly say, I'm doing this on behalf of the Klingon Emperor, it is very clearly carrying that connotation. You would, yeah.
It's like, do you have more presents for us? It's like, dude, no. Like, you can't, no. It's like, that'd be like us. I mean, pick a hostile country. And, I mean, it's like, sure, we gave weapons to the Iranians just because, you know, like we wanted to destabilize Afghanistan more. So, you know, we're giving them weapons now.
The world more. But anyway,
No.
Yeah. And as related to that example, Josh, is something that you flagged earlier, which is also just the part where this is weapons dealing. And then specifically is weapons dealing to what I would argue is a terrorist activity. So, because the Paklids do not seem to be that interested in what we would think of as formal warfare. They don't seem to distinguish between, although we haven't really seen it as much because it's a fun, friendly, hilarious show. We haven't seen them, you know, preying upon civilian vessels, but I seriously doubt that they are avoiding targeting civilian vessels when they're doing these things. And so what we generally have is, you know, there's been no declared war, but you have Paklids that are attacking passing Starfleet vessels or Vulcan vessels or anything. And so in that circumstance, you know, there's these, we have, normally we actually need to like debate sort of nuances about whether or not someone is actually supporting a terrorist group by giving them something, or even, you know, the edge cases are like if somebody gives it like legal advice about a topic, those kinds of things. But this is not an edge case. This is handing over bombs. Ironically, that they don't realize they're single use, so that's nice. But bombs to a group that is either, number one, a potential adversary of the Klingons, who are still allied with the Federation at this time, I believe. So that's, like you mentioned, treason. And then the second one is might be a terrorist organization, in which case this is absolutely lending material support to a terrorist organization.
Yeah, it's just, and this is the time when Martog is the emperor, or excuse me, the chancellor. Mm-hmm. The clone of Kalis is the emperor at this point in time. Other topic. So Martog,
interesting episode. Very, as like most of Star Trek, very interesting. But continue.
Martog's the type of guy to like kill a dude over that crap. And you know what? He'd be right.
Oh, and you know, Josh, one of the things that can be punished by death in the ECMJ, treason.
Yeah, it's like you did what?
Yeah.
You fired on a starship? We went through the Dominion War together. What are you thinking? Like, what the hell, dude? No. So yeah, it's absolutely treason, and Klingon style justice is a little rough and tumble compared to ours, but it's at least very similar in intent, you know, compared to say Cardassian, which is more like Soviet gulag style. It's rough and tumble. It's like a bar fight, but the elements are there in a way that we would understand them if a lawyer had to appear pro hoc vice in a Klingon court. Might go home with a bruise or two, but the guts.
That's a hilarious thought, Josh.
Yeah, it's like, well, yeah, but the guts of how the system works is fundamentally the same. You know, it's still a trial.
Mm-hmm.
That captain should have gotten one. However, I'm glad the lower decker who rose to first officer pretty quickly for like a half hour.
Yeah, that's what it seems like.
I mean, that's a fast way to become a captain. And again, it highlights, you know, you should take care of the Targ. You know, he's a very good boy. And so, you know, again, The big scary dog had his back.
Yeah. I also want to, this is the next topic that you wanted to talk about. Good. So I'm not getting off topic, but I did want to mention that in just one in an ongoing series of incidents in which this show has shown its really deep love and knowledge of Star Trek lore includes the challenge, right? And the lead up to the challenge, because that's important. So, you know, I said before that, you know, one of the ways you get promoted in the Klingon structure appears to be killing your superior officer. However, that is under certain circumstances. It's in a duel. And there are only certain circumstances in which you can have a duel. It's not just like, you know, alternate reality Starfleet in which everyone is just murdering each other in the shadows. And this, I think, was a great example of that system and the conditions under which someone could have a challenge that they couldn't refuse, essentially.
Yeah, it was, it fit their system. It would not have happened in a Federation system.
No, no.
But it fit the Klingon system, and that was very well done.
Yes, and it, I just wanted to, last thought on that, is it harkened back to me to the episode of Deep Space Nine in which Quark ended up representing a noble Klingon house that had been on the decline, in the sense that the thing that caused the dishonor that the first officer challenged the captain with was not fundamentally the stuff that we talked about, like the Logan Act and other things that the Klingons may or may not have. The thing that really broke the camel's back here, as it were, is that he was using subterfuge and deception in a very Tal Shiar way, but that is not how the Klingons do battle. And it's an interesting concept because obviously you could get more in certain circumstances by using those tactics. In this case, this captain who was determined to go to an actual war, you know, who doesn't matter with who, was maybe going to succeed in causing the destabilization of the Federation and then therefore a Klingon invasion, which to him would have been glorious. But he was doing it through methods that were off limits for a Klingon captain.
I think Martok would have put a stop to it, that he would have figured
that
out.
That too.
And if this is, I'm not quite sure how the timing lines up, but if it's post-Nemesis, then Worf should be the first officer on the Enterprise. If it's not post-Nemesis, then Worf should be like the Federation ambassador hanging out with Martok, hunting things.
Mm-hmm.
And both of them are together going like, what's going on? This ain't right. Like, because they would figure it out. On the flip side, if it's not yet on Nemesis time, then Martok is smart enough to do it on his own. Now, this all gets to a big issue of illegal orders being issued by the Klingon captain. And that's part of the reason why it's okay for the first officer to stand up in a very Crimson Tide type of way. And it was nice to see the first officer bring up the fact that there have been other Klingons who've tried to sabotage peace, which, and the fact that they saw that as a dishonorable thing.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, they're mocking the Vulcans for like live long and cower and, you know,
that was pretty funny.
Things you would expect the Klingons to talk smack about the Vulcans, like you would expect them to do that. That said, this fits nicely because there's no duty to follow an illegal order. Additionally, you can't be, if you say no, you shouldn't be prosecuted for not issuing or not following an illegal order. And you throw in, you know, there's a great quote from D.C. Circuit Judge Washington in 1813 that says, "It is repugnant to reason and to the positive law of the land. No military civilian officer or civil officer can command an inferior to violate the law of his country, nor will such command excuse, must less justify the act."
Mm-hmm.
First off, I love it when a judge throws down repugnant. That's always just a chef kiss for legal analysis right out of the gate. But, you know, here the first officer and literally everyone on board go like, we just gave weapons to who? And the captain's openly talking about defying the Empire to start a war. You would think more than would be speaking up, that there's an admiral that they should be sending an email to going like, yo. you know, like this is when everyone should stand up and go like, no, we're not doing this. Like, yeah, we're not starting a war. We just had two. We had the, you know, we got sidetracked into war because of the Dominion and the Klingons fighting the Federation, and then fought the Dominion proper. No, we're done with this crap. The Emperor wants to expand and do all the empire-y things, but you got to do it honorably.
In defense of the crew, I don't know that it was apparent to the people on the ship, except for the captain, obviously, that what they were doing was not sanctioned by the Empire, which, you know, is the crux of what's making it illegal, because there's a lot of things that you could be ordered to do in the military that seem like, oh, you know, I'm just going to throw out, like, because this came out in, you know, some cables from like a few years ago, but, you know, spying on allies, things like that, that might seem on their face to be problematic, something that might inspire some skepticism. But at the end of the day, you know, we expect people to follow orders. And so I want to, first of all, this is a great opportunity to mention that the Legal Geeks podcast should not be construed as legal advice, but, you know, It is true that a soldier in the U.S. military cannot be prosecuted for refusing to follow an illegal order. Kind of like we were just talking about, right, refusal to follow an order before is, in general, something that you can be prosecuted for under UCMJ, not punished by death, but still, it is an actual offense. Not included in that, though, or included in that definition is that it has to be a lawful order. And we do expect, this is something that we have in our military culture, besides that it's reflected in the military code, is we do expect people in the U.S. military not to be automatons. We expect them people to think for themselves, to make important judgment calls. And I think Josh, you and I might have talked about this a little bit. I know I've talked about it before, but that, you know, compared to other contemporary militaries, especially the previous Soviet Union, U.S. soldiers are generally expected to and trained to take over the mission in case their officer is killed, and things like that. So as opposed to compartmentalizing it and just here's your orders, go do it. There's a lot of real thinking and reasoning and judgment calls that we expect soldiers to make. I will just say, though, that, you know, you should be reasonably sure that it's not a lawful order before you take that gamble. We don't expect, and the code probably would not defend, somebody who is constantly refusing to follow orders under the belief, erroneous belief, that they are unlawful orders. But this is exactly the backstop for, you know, the really horrible things that we can see military people doing in a lot of places in history, and very unfun things for this podcast.
Yeah, there's case law that gets into this that says an illegal order is obvious on its face. So let's get into that. If you're ordered to shoot all the civilians in the village, that's illegal on its face. If there's a unarmed prisoner face down on the ground and you're told to shoot him in the back of the head, that's illegal on its face. That's My Lai and a post-World War II case that was in Europe. There are things that didn't happen but were scary examples where when the former president asked, could we just shoot refugees at the border to keep them from crossing? If he had ordered that, that would have been an illegal order. When he was
told, it would have been facially unlawful is the important distinction here, as opposed to, you know, if you have to hem and haw about it, if you can make an argument on the other side that is no longer facially unlawful.
Yeah, it's like, and again, his counter to that was, well, how about we just shoot him in the legs? And again, the lawyers in the room said, no.
No, and just can I point out, and this has been said a number of times on this show, one of the fundamental principles of the law of war is that you don't target civilians. It doesn't matter that you're only targeting parts of them. If the target is a civilian, well, that's that.
We only crippled them. You don't get to do that. It's like, well, we didn't want them to cross the border, because we don't need refugees. It's like, it's not a crime. So those are
even if it's a crime, we have process. That is one of the most fundamental things about our society. It's actually not that we, you know, have free speech, which is important, but it's in the First Amendment. The thing that is most important about our society is process, because we could change, we could abolish the First Amendment if we had enough popular support. Process, guys. Even if if you could punish someone by death, which you can't for illegally crossing the border, you have to go through all of that process first. And it's exactly what we've been talking about for a lot of this episode.
Yeah, again, it's facially wrong on its face. And if they knew, wait, we're hanging out with the Packleds, that's a red flag. And I was just ordered to beam over a WMD.
Yeah!
It wasn't send it over arm because we're going to blow it up. Like, that would be a different question. It's like, why are we supplying them weapons? And those are, again, that would be a more nuanced discussion.
Yeah, which is why I'm not, which is why I think the crew, assuming that if this first officer had either not stood up to the captain or not succeeded in standing up to the captain, I'm going to give the crew the benefit of the doubt that at the point at which he declares to them that what they've been doing is not sanctioned, the point he orders them to, you know, continue firing on this Federation vessel against Klingon, against the orders of the Empire, right? Not with the orders of the Empire. I'm going to give the crew the benefit of the doubt that they also would have refused to follow those orders, if not also challenge the captain.
If the crew had refused to fire on the Cerritos, that they would have been in a defendable position, because there is enough reason that why the heck are we firing on an ally?
What I mean, Josh, is that it's a little different than if it were a civilian Starfleet vessel, in the sense that the Klingon Emperor might have decided that they needed to start ramping up to take over parts of and declare war, and maybe that's what they're doing. It is not necessarily as facially obviously unlawful if you're being asked to target a military vessel.
I think they would be within their rights to say, I'm not doing this. That we're hanging out with a
no. It's problematic. Nobody questions it, but I guess I'm being their defense lawyer.
I think they would have a right to say no. When it's like, we're hanging out with a known threat, that's a problem. And now you just ordered us to fire on not one ally, but two. Like that.
Well, can I play devil's advocate with you, Josh?
Go right ahead.
Yeah. So let's assume that we'll go with this hypothetical in which a captured Federation starship Cerritos is actually loaded up with bioweapons and is on a course for the Klingon homeworld. It is intercepted by this bird of prey, which receives orders that if they see a starship called Cerritos, even though it's flying Federation colors, even though they're greeted by someone who appears to be a Federation captain, they have to destroy it on site.
That's a different fact pattern.
I know, but what I'm saying is that the crew is not currently aware that the captain is acting against the orders of the Klingon Empire. And if you have each individual officer on this ship not having had that information, that briefing, instead questioning, why are we being asked to fire on a ship which we believe to be our ally, then you might have this like nightmare scenario in which you know, I agree that the best thing to do would be to just communicate, but it is not a facially unlawful order.
Okay, let's put a spin on that with something contemporary. Let's say that you have a US destroyer crew in the South China Sea, and that the captain says, fire on that Taiwanese frigate. And the response, what? Like, we sell them ships, we're here. Where we hang out in the streets of Formosa to help make sure and show the flag to the People's Republic of China that, you know, Taiwan is a separate country. And if we're suddenly going to start firing on Taiwanese ships, that's a...
I'm just saying it could be possible that the Taiwanese ship is in fact not a Taiwanese ship. It just appears to be a Taiwanese ship.
Yeah, but we don't want our officers being automatons like that. So asking...
No, we don't want them being automatons, but we don't want them in a situation in which time is of the essence to be debating. If it's debatable, then that is where this doesn't protect you.
Yeah, but again, let's pick an ally. Go sink the British aircraft carrier would be what?
I'm just going to just rephrase that slightly, which is there is a British plane that is inbound over San Francisco. And you get orders to shoot it down.
Different, because a plane flying in, we've learned the hard way that those can be WMDs in a very ugly way.
I'm just gonna like I'm going to disagree with you on this one, Josh, because I think that there are scenarios in which, you know, something is not facially unlawful under the laws of the United States or the laws of war, but, you know, might inspire questioning. Those are the kinds of things where I'm not sure that you're going to win on a defense that it was an unlawful order.
Yeah, I would bet on our people being smart enough to go, that's wrong.
The last thing that I'll say is that it does depend a little bit on whether or not you turn out to be right in these scenarios because of prosecutorial discretion. Right. So in a scenario in which you refuse to follow an order and it turns out that it was because there was this is an actual incident. It was because the radar picked up a flock of birds and thought it was inbound ICMBs. And yeah. You just had a feeling and you broke all the protocols and did not fire the second strike. Right.
Yeah. But,
to the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was actually a pretty serious break of protocol. If it had actually been an inbound, you know, first assault, you have a very short window in order to try to get off a second strike. But it turns out that you were right. And I think that does make a difference, not necessarily in whether or not you broke the protocols and that could be punished, but whether or not someone is actually going to punish you for that.
Yeah, the fact that they're... thank God people that both the Soviet Union and the United States had missile silos had the wherewithal to go like, I'm not turning the key. This seems wrong. And for it to be a solar flare or computer glitch, but for the grace of God, we didn't get annihilated in 1983, is a good thing. Because again, somebody said, this doesn't look right. I'm not following the checklist just because it says there are inbound ICBMs. So
what I'm trying to highlight is that it still technically was a very serious breach of protocol in the sense that what you don't want is the person whose finger is on the button getting the order and saying, not today.
That's different. We want people to think.
I agree, but I'm just saying that the thing that defends you is when it is facially unlawful, and as long as it's debatable, and it can be debatable in a lot of these contexts, is all I'm just trying to point out. I will agree with you, though, that when it comes down to it, if you are right, if they were like, this doesn't feel right, we're not going to shoot the Allied ship, and it turns out that their captain actually had been, you know, on drugs that day, or had been replaced by a doppelganger that day, there's no universe in which I think, you know, a military prosecutor is going to try to bring a case against those soldiers, even if at the time, subjectively, they didn't have a good reason.
Yeah, there are lots of examples that we could go down from Korean airliners getting shot down to Iranian airliners. There's many examples. Let's go to something that would be very un-Silicon Valley. And the Vulcan cruiser Chaval. And we have Talin, who's quickly becoming my favorite Vulcan.
She gets punished. She's got some stiff competition, is all I'll say.
Yeah, but it's just, there's some endearing, strong first showing. Very strong first showing. Because she gets punished for taking the initiative. And in Silicon Valley, law firms, if you have somebody who's like, yeah, I stayed up working late on something because I wanted to figure out how it worked and I've made it work better. Normally, those are the people you promote, that you want to retain them because they're smart, they're effective, and they're able to enhance your organization. You want to value them. The Vulcans don't value that. And they see it as an emotional outburst. And she does have a lot of qualities of saying, like, I felt, and then correcting it. So, you know, too, it was logical.
Mm-hmm. Or
I think she used, I had a gut feeling.
She did.
Which is, okay, was there a Romulan great grandma? Like, how did that happen? Or were you just hanging out with, you know, humans in the schoolyard at some point in time, and then some of that rubbed off on her. But normally you don't, I mean, the way that they argue on the Vulcan ship is fascinating.
Oh, yes.
you get the between the lower deckers, you have some very catty exchanges about, well, I thought you would want to appreciate data analytics as well. I mean, that sort of just, super, super catty, shot fired at somebody.
Yeah, I just suggest that you join me in expanding your perspective over the utility of logic. That sounds like an insult.
Well done. Well done, kid. Well done. Like you, that's the type, it's like, make her a manager. Like we want that type of initiative. And it's what saves the ship, ultimately. And the reward for that is, I'm going to send you to a Federation ship. Like that's, it's like, you would all be dead. Granted, you likely wouldn't have been in the situation to begin with.
Also true. Well, then the Cerritos would be dead. But...
and well, depending on the timing of the Klingon ship having a change in management, that could have been a factor with it. But it's she did nothing wrong by our standards.
Our standards.
By their standards, where it's just, there's no room for creativity or someone showing initiative.
So what in what we've seen of Vulcan culture throughout Star Trek, I'm not sure that it's fair to say that there's no room for creativity in Vulcan society. There's a lot of really interesting Vulcan art and music and literature that is at least referenced, if not shown, in various pieces of Star Trek media. What I think is interesting, and it is the most prominent difference in Starfleet culture versus Vulcan culture in this episode, is how you approach the idea of being passionate, right? So she takes these initiatives, not at least after she, in her first admission and before she corrects herself, not out of something purely logical and dispassionate, but because she is really interested in these things. She mm-hmm. wants to spend her time rather than sleep the full cycle or meditate, wants to be working on these things that she's really passionate about. It is a quality that you're absolutely right. In our society, we value greatly, obviously everything in moderation, but it is a generally considered to be a virtue rather than a vice. And so I also want to just play devil's advocate for Vulcan culture briefly, which is that, they Vulcans don't necessarily prize suppressing or downplaying those kinds of qualities and devotions because they're vindictive or because they're mean or because of simple religious fanaticism. There has been discussion in Star Trek of why they even have the religion of logic. And it's right there in the original series, I believe, in which, there's an episode in which Spock, I believe, talks about how he has extremely deep and powerful emotions, and that comes from his Vulcan side. The Vulcans have such difficult time controlling their emotions and not acting violently. They have a very violent past in their society, that the religion of logic and the way in which they live in this extremely suppressed manner is designed to counteract that. And so I find that interesting, right? So we consider passion to be a virtue, but to just speak in defense of the Vulcan captain doing as he did, the way that, like, if their society did not discourage people from being passionate, the fear for them is that they would again devolve into violent passion.
Lights, this is something interesting in a way to contrast Vulcans and Klingons. I enjoy looking at ethical decision-making through the lens of both Spock and Worf, because both are in Starfleet, and you get, they basically arrive at the same conclusions, but one's using logic and the other's using honor, passion, but they're trying to reach the same goal. On the Shaval, we have the Vulcan who uses passion to help save the day. And on the Cheetah, we have a Klingon that uses logic to save the day. And it's part of the reason why they're fascinating to look at, because they arrive at where they need to go. And it's a little different than the Spock and Worf comparison, because both try to stay true to Federation values and using their cultural background to achieve those goals. Here they flip them just a little bit. And that was unique. I do hope that we get to see more of these characters. And I can't help but wonder if Tilden's captain was also her dad.
Oh.
Just by the way that they interacted. And also the way that she walked out of the captain's ready room was very reminiscent of Mariner walking out from her mom.
I would say that I agree. Now that you've mentioned it, I think that's a very, very similar dynamic.
It's like that Vulcan captain showed a fair amount of interest in one ensign or whatever their lowest rank is. Or
yeah, and her initial reaction was that, oh, I'm being sent back to Vulcan. And the fact that she instead is getting reassigned to a Federation ship, they term it as horrible punishment, but it's probably better.
Yeah, she's not getting kicked out of the service. She's being sent somewhere else. What will be interesting if they treat it like an officer exchange program in which she would wear her Vulcan uniform, as opposed to being reassigned to Starfleet in its entirety and mm-hmm. thus making a uniform change. I'm curious to see how they go. Because again, like if a British officer spends a tour with a US warship, he stays in his British uniform. You know, like it's how we roll. It's like it's how we do officer exchanges. And we've seen that to a degree already in Next Gen episodes.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious if they do more with that. So let's pivot to did you have any other comments on Tilden?
No, not more than the stuff that I want to chat with you about the Cerritos.
Yeah, and because there's a lot there. So hit me with what you saw first.
So first of all, I really loved this episode when it comes to the Cerritos and all of the like weird, craziest, like it was so reference dense with all of the different recreational activities that crew members have done over the course of several series. So like you had, you know, the medieval princess dressed man coming out of the holodeck. You had someone who was in the outfit, I believe, that Data wore when he was pretending to be Holmes. And I absolutely love the drawn out scene from, I'm going to blank on the number, but the Star Trek movie in which there's the rock climbing. Yes, thank you, five. The rock climbing scene down to the shirt. So my partner, James, isn't as big a Star Trek nerd as I am, but we watched those movies together and he immediately noticed that. He's like, that's Captain Kirk's shirt. Go climb a rock. It was fantastic. This was just such a delight. This is one of the reasons why this is such a homer for me, is just this part alone.
There's a lot there. So it is so reverential. It's like you could drown in it. But it's not often you do a Star Trek V reference that's funny. And they did. Now, granted, it's hard to mess up Yosemite. So there's that. But that, again, immediately raised the issue of, were the safety protocols on? And the doctor, I don't know.
Which seems like there have to be rules involving, like, consenting to go on a holodeck program with someone, and they don't tell you that they've turned the safeties off. Like, I'm sure there are rules about that.
It's like, this adventure has tiger traps, FYI. And it's like, what? You know, I don't want to get impaled. So there's that. So, and again, flying around in Spock boots, cool. But like, there has to be safety protocols in there.
Or at least everyone has to be aware that they're off before they step inside. It's like, you know, if you wanted to do a training session with Worf, sure, you can have the safeties turned off. But if he doesn't tell you before he hits you with the bat, that's a problem.
Yeah. And yeah, it's like speaking of like filling out paperwork, one of our mutual friends who's a federal judge, like they're in Vegas for their anniversary, renewed their vows. They did like one of those bungee jumps off a building. God knows the paperwork to go do that. It's like, I wouldn't, like, I'm not going to hop out of a perfectly good airplane, nor will I hop out of a building. No, that's just not my idea of a good time. But, you know, because God, imagine the paperwork. That said, so we have that half of it. You have the Hawaiian aspect.
Yes, which was also really funny. James called it, by the way, that none of them were going to be from Hawaii.
It's just, it's like it all snowballed. You know, I wasn't, now granted, what threw me for a surprise was Ransom had the same issue as well. It's like, it's just stuck with me, man. And like, it just, he thought it was, I didn't know how to get out. And it's like, now it's 20 years later and here I am. It's like, so yeah, that happened. But is that lying to a superior officer? I mean, is it a form of resume fraud? It's this weird, it's a fraud. And I mean, because they're lying, you know, you could just say it could be the unbecoming aspect of the military code of justice. That's just so weird.
So there are a lot of catch-alls in the UCMJ. So I'll just say that you could probably, depending on how egregious this behavior was, you could probably fit it into one of the catch-alls. When it comes to if this weren't UCMJ, right, and instead we're in civilian law territory, just regular fraud, I'd say the one thing that I could think of if I were, you know, Ransom's defense lawyer, because he's lying to a superior officer, or Boimler's when he's lying to Ransom, would be injury. That they're not causing injury yet, at least as far as we've seen. So that would be the only thing that I could really think of. I think it does fit a lot of the other elements, though, including intent to defraud. But it's just the part where they're not really hurting anything. And it's not, you know, an actual, if it were actually a requirement of promotion that you have to have something important in common with yourself, then that might be more akin to resume fraud. This is, you know, trying to just like lie in order to hang out with the person. It's like, I don't know if you've ever had this experience, Josh, but I've definitely fudged how much I care about sports in order to socialize with superiors at workplaces.
Yes, I love bowling, you know, like, I mean, I actually do like that, but yeah, there are some sport events. It's like, if you invite me to a baseball game, absolutely. After that, it's like, maybe.
Oh yeah, yeah. I don't mean to say that there are no sports that I love and watch, but I have in the past represented that I really like professional basketball and I do not. So
it's like, I really enjoy hockey. Like, that'd be fun to go to. So there's that aspect of it. Apparently you have to have a manual in order to talk to Schatz without, without things going sideways. Because there's a dude who apparently has lots of trauma. And it's interesting to see that Rutherford is now buddies with him. And like, if a dude died saving your life, you're probably going to start hanging out together.
Yeah. Because
that just makes
especially
sense.
Especially after Shax shared the secret of the afterlife with him.
You have to fight three faceless versions of your father at the Black Mountain. Yeah, so there's that. So is asking about, did he learn pottery on Bajor, grounds for negligent infliction of emotional distress? And that just seems really weird.
I mean, can it? It's still like a duty of reasonable care, right?
It's how is that like negligent? It's
like, that's what I mean. Under the ordinary definition of negligence, right, which is that we owe each other duties of reasonable care, which essentially means that we act people when dealing with each other, take or like what reasonable people would do in order to take care or to take precautions. And an ordinary person, even knowing Shax, because you can adapt the ordinary person standard, right, to specific situations. How could you possibly know that you shouldn't bring up pottery and where he learned how to do it?
Yeah. Fighting fascism is a full-time job. It's like, well, we agree, but how many other Bajorans are, you know, that short fused about the Cardassian occupation? And because if the question had been like, oh, where did you learn pottery? There would not have been the explosive reply.
Right. Oh, if he had instead asked, like, so how was your time during the occupation? That might be closer. That doesn't seem reasonable.
So were you a collaborator? Things like that could be fighting words to.
Right. It's a bit of the moving standard, right? And so in this case, it's not just an ordinary person in any situation. It's an ordinary person talking to a Bajoran.
Yeah, if you ask, okay, could you tell me the significance of your earring? And like, that's not on its face offensive.
It's not an unreasonable thing to do.
Yeah, it's like, could you tell me, what does this all symbolize? You know, like, the Vulcans have their, you know, infinite diversity and infinite combination, you know, medallion. Like, that's not unreasonable. Could you tell me about this? Like, because like
that. If it just so happens that bringing that up triggers a deep-seated trauma because the earring had been given to you by your dying mother after she'd been tortured by I think, which actually might have happened for Kira or something like that, but it's a reasonable person standard. The fact that this person had a particular vulnerability that a reasonable person wouldn't have expected means it's probably not negligent infliction of emotional distress.
Starkly, it's about seeking out strange new worlds and new civilizations. Asking like about somebody's civilization seems kind of par for the course.
Oh yeah.
It's why you're there. And if the response is like the guy throws a punch at you, it's like, what? I mean, I wasn't expecting that. Like, I didn't ask
anything. Also, it doesn't matter if somebody did negligently or intentionally inflict emotional distress. The answer is never violence.
Yeah, it's like, that's super weird. And again, it then turns into a therapy moment of like, work it out in the clay.
I love that about Shax, that he does pottery for anger management. I really love that.
I'm going to make a little ashtray in the shape of a kitten for my incense ashes. It's like, oh, okay. Like, I was not expecting that.
Oh, it's okay. Adorable.
It's just, again, dude that I'd hang out with. I see why Rutherford is. Cool. So we have that. We have Mariner and Mom, and like when they're in their shooting competition, Mariner is very, very right to be upset about Mom telling people that Mariner had bad cramps. Like, that was, I understand why she'd be very, very upset. And then the counter throwdown of I'll have your.
I'll tell people you've been messing with the ship's environmental controls to compensate for your hot flashes.
It's like, part of me just wants to see the mother-daughter dynamic and have popcorn, just because, like they're very much on the same team when they need to be, and which again happens in this episode when the fighting actually starts, and which is again, it's like that's kind of the core values of Trek. I did enjoy when everyone goes to battle stations and everyone's rushing out from whatever holo program.
Yes.
So you have the helmsman who looks like she was on some skiing adventure with her pink outfit and earmuffs. Shaq still has the apron on from, you know, his adventure. And the fact the doctor goes to the bridge is kind of a new one. But again, it's like, okay, that's, I mean, like, in no one's phased by it. It's like, oh no, that's her thing. That's her hobby. She's really into, you know, snowboarding or whatever. Cool. Okay. That was actually very enjoyable.
I want to quickly throw out there, in case anybody who makes the show watches this, but I and my boyfriend definitely appreciated the fact that the doctor's harness was actually correctly drawn for climbing.
Wow.
I can't tell you how many times I see stuff where it's depicting rock climbing and, you know, they either just don't draw it right or they're not wearing it right in live action stuff. So.
And I took stagecraft when I was a freshman in high school, and the teacher was also the drama teacher. And she made some comment about technical specs like that, that there's always someone in the audience who knows how it's supposed to be. Therefore, we're going to make it look right. And so they didn't fake it. They actually researched it. Cool. Good for them.
Yes.
Maybe the person who wrote that part of the episode or someone on the creative team is into rock climbing. And
it wouldn't surprise me. There's like a great overlap, a large overlap between nerddom and climbers. I don't know why, but it's there. Myself included.
Large number of lawyers who like Star Trek, you know, like, and there's that's a thing. So, yeah. So with that, there's a lot of good stuff. I did watch this episode with black licorice.
Yes.
Because I like black licorice. I mean, I also like purple and red, but yeah, I mean, I thought profits a little
bit. As a substitute for water, though?
No, well, yeah. Better than like drinking oil. I mean, like, I would be fine with.
Sure.
It's survival. It's not like we're going to make a house here and this is going to be the way of life going forward. That would get old fast. But no, I like black licorice. So there. So any other things that you noticed?
Yes, I have one last thought. Thank you for checking. I had one last thought, which was just, again, to highlight how awesome this show is and how true to Trek it is that also the plot line involving the everybody pretending to be from Hawaii resolved with an expression of the meritocratic aspiration that Star Trek has always expressed, in the sense that, you know, at first it seems like because they all turn out to be from moons, except for Boimler, he's cut out of the social clique again, and he's worried that that's going to affect him professionally. And the show ends with showing that it is not. So Ransom doesn't need to be rubbing elbows at a luau with Boimler to appreciate that he is an excellent officer and to recognize that. And he makes that kind of clear at the end. And it's just so true to Trek. I love it.
That agreed to have the other little spastic cadet, you know, probably somebody from the academy who's on their, you know, summer tour on a ship, come up and ask those questions. I was really hoping, with Boimler being from Modesto, that he would pivot to, I'm from Modesto, like George Lucas. I was so hoping for that type of call out to take place so that the Trek people can tip the hat to the Star Wars people. Would be just a chef's kiss of creativity.
Could still happen someday. Again, if anybody who makes the show watches this.
Why have him from Modesto? Like, it's a very specific Central Valley town. You know, he didn't say Sacramento, didn't say Houston, which is next door to Modesto.
Not widely known outside of California, right?
Yeah, so maybe one of the writers is from there, but if you pick Modesto, and one of the most famous people from Modesto is George Lucas, why not take that and have some fun with it? Because, again, the Venn diagram of people who like Star Trek and Star Wars, you know, isn't a circle, but it's close. There's a lot of overlap, especially in the late 70s. Then it was a circle. So, it kind of probably like that. Yeah, there's probably a lot of overlap. So any other points?
That was my only closing thought, but I'm really glad you reminded me that I did have a closing thought.
Got your back. So with that, everyone, We won't say the schedule because it's not posted yet, but we will be at Denver Fan Expo. And so stay tuned for info on the panels we will have. And I did say plural, and the dates and times for those. So super, it'll be the first con that I've gone to since March 2020. And very excited to actually see human beings again in a social situation with people who love pop culture and Star Trek and all the other things that we know and love. So a lot to do before Halloween weekend. So with that, everyone stay safe, stay healthy. You can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram with the Legal Geeks. If you listen to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher, please like or send a review. We appreciate that. So until then, stay geeky. Take care, all.